I'm just going to begin this week with the demonstration on Gaza in London. My understanding is that there were demonstrations in 30 different countries. And indeed, if we look at Britain, there were a whole number of different demonstrations throughout the country. But it should be mentioned, at least according to Socialist Workers' Party, and I've got no reason to doubt it, they were reporting that some 500,000 people took part yesterday in London. And I wasn't counting, but I was sort of timing, and I got there roughly speaking about 11:45. That was before the demonstration was due to start. I would have thought 3 hours, 3.5 hours after that, I saw the demonstration through to the final police line at the end. I have to say that I was completely frozen by the end of the demonstration. I was taking photographs, other comrades were distributing the Weekly Worker. I think the response was positive. It's very hard to sum up a demonstration of 500,000 and to give it a single character. But if I was, sort of forced to, I would say that its character was more militant than previously. Yes, there were a lot of, and quite rightly, demands for an immediate ceasefire, immediate cessation of hostilities from Israel. But my general judgment was that, demands, simply because of what is going on in Gaza, have become more critical of Israel, less peacenik, if you were going to describe it in one word. There were, according to the police, 9 arrests. I have to say that I don't know the details, but it does strike me that some of the arrests are for utterly trivial nonsense. So I do know that one of the arrests, at least, was for stickers. I mean, there were just stickers everywhere. People were putting them up on lampposts and, buildings, you name it. So I don't know if the police saw someone doing that and nabbed them, but that would seem to be the case. There was also arrest for supporting a proscribed organization. As we all know, anyone who listens to the BBC will know as soon as they mention the H word, they begin, immediately afterwards by saying that this is a proscribed organization in Britain and many other countries in the world. And I presume that that will now include the Houthis. And, I think it is worthwhile saying that in terms of previous demonstrations, the two notable developments to me, other than sort of judging things in a very artistic, subjective fashion, were the appearance of not huge numbers, but nonetheless significant numbers of South African flags. I'll come obviously to the court case in The Hague, but also a large number of, homemade cardboard slogans praising the Houthis and their resistance, their contribution to the resistance to Israel's attack on Gaza. In terms of just looking at the police, they were certainly aggressively filming. I did try to follow some sort of police contingent, but who are diving in looking for somebody or some incident in the demonstration, but I think they missed them, so I didn't pursue that particular one. But nine arrests, and as I say, nine arrests on the basis of pretty heavy policing, but this time no moral panic of the sort that was introduced by our former Home Secretary Suella Braverman, who remember was describing these marches as hate marches, was agitating for the Metropolitan Police to issue a ban on them. This time, 500,000 people, marched, and quite frankly, there was no incidents, in any serious sense worth reporting, except over the top policing. And of course, last time round, what we had as a result, a direct result of Suella Braverman and her agitation, yes, we had Whitehall invaded, but by the wrong sort. It wasn't invaded, of course, by Palestinian protesters determined to upset the establishment's remembrance of, British fighters who'd fallen in the name of Queen and or King and country in previous wars, but a right-wing mob that turned up that did disrupt that holy moment for the establishment. It's also been mentioned to me, and didn't really occur to me, but it wouldn't surprise me, the proportion of women on the demonstration. And it also ought to be added that perhaps there were more white people on the demonstration than previously, but neither particularly, neither of those observations come from me. It didn't particularly impact on me. In other words, there were plenty of South Asian people, plenty of people, in terms of their origins from the Middle East. I'm sure there were plenty of women, but were there more women proportionately there than previously? I don't know. One thing I would say is once again, and I think in a particularly militant fashion, there was a what described itself as a Jewish bloc that had a number of different organizations behind its main banner, and I think that their presence is very important, in part to counter anyone with backward political ideas who fall for the idea of official Israeli Zionist ideology that Israel is the homeland for all Jews. Israel acts on behalf of all Jews with the complicity of all Jews. That's clearly not the case. And indeed, what we actually have is a situation, this is my understanding, a very good percentage of British Jews completely disassociate themselves from Israel's actions. And of course, if you're a Zionist, I think you're going to have increasing problems actually of associating yourself with Israel's actions, in spite of what the US government says, in spite of what the UK government says. So I just wanted to move on. I'm no expert, as you can tell, on the Middle East, so I'm no expert on the Houthis. But I thought I would do just a modicum of research, because besides having the BBC routinely telling us that Hamas is a proscribed organization in the UK and other such countries, were also routinely told by the BBC and other such media outlets that the Houthis, this is the group in North Yemen, are proxies of Iran. I'm very dubious about that description myself. Certainly true that in terms of financial and logistical support, they undoubtedly get help from Iran. But once you actually look at the history of this particular group, once you understand the history indeed of Yemen, the idea that the Houthis are acting as an arm, an extension of the Iranian government, I think is highly dubious. I personally think while they get, as I said, financial and logistical support, they're also acting simply according to their own interests and their own view of the world. And one thing that I'm pretty much convinced of is that if you take the capital city of Yemen, Sana'a, the fact that the United States, supported by its yapdog, the United Kingdom, has missiled and bombed Yemeni targets in retaliation for strikes on ships in the Red Sea has actually enhanced the popularity of the regime. I'll call it in North Lem North Yemen because that's actually what we're dealing with. And indeed, I would argue that if yesterday's demonstration in London is anything to go by, i.e., people making placards praising the action of the Houthis in solidarity with the Gazan population, that what is true for London will be true double in Amman, in Cairo, in Alexandria, in Baghdad, and other Arab and Muslim cities. Of course, Britain was going to support this US action, but it's notable, when we have spokespersons for, the Ministry of Defense on the media, that they have to sort of stretch out pretty wide to find any other support. No one participated, as far as I understand it, other than Britain. Using some Tornado aircraft, I think, flown from Cyprus for this particular action. France notably didn't. But we are told that Australia supports it. Well, that's great, isn't it? And one notable absence, which I think is significant, of course, is Saudi Arabia. Why? Because Saudi Arabia has been engaged in a war against the Houthis since 2015, has come out bad from that war with the Houthis. It's been on the losing side. It's got a bloody nose from their engagement with the Houthis and are in the midst of negotiations trying to come to a deal with the Houthis. So Saudi Arabia, far from being bellicose, has issued a statement urging restraint. Whether that will actually happen for the reasons I've already alluded to, I don't know. But the idea that the Houthis, because they've been bombed by the United States, okay, many times more powerful, of course, than Saudi Arabia, nonetheless, Saudi Arabia has been engaged in both a war, a land war with the Houthis, but also an air war with the Houthis, what, for sort of 7 years? So the idea that the Houthis, have been hit in terms of missile sites or radar sites will now throw up its hands and surrender to the might of US imperialism, I think, is highly dubious. Quite the opposite, I would actually guess. And the chances are that by ratcheting things up, what will happen is both, there'll be economic problems. So we're told that in terms of, merchant ships, it will add £1 million to the cost of their journey. They have to reroute them around the Cape. What's that going to mean in terms of Egypt's economy at the present time? I haven't got a clue. I would guess that two main sources of revenue for Egypt are pretty much under threat at the moment, and one is tourism, but the other, of course, is the Suez Canal route. What that then means in terms of the overall Egyptian economy, well, it can only mean bad, and that means in terms of Egypt instability for a regime that is inherently unstable, i.e. sort of the military securocrat regime of Sisi, who really took over, of course, from Mubarak with that interregnum of a free vote that put the Muslim Brotherhood into office, if not into power. Okay, just to carry on about the Houthis. My understanding is that in religious terms, not that this is crucial, but I think it is worthwhile pointing out, in religious terms, while the Houthis can be regarded as Shia, part of the sort of Shia tradition in Islam, they would be part of the Shia religion in Islam that is the closest to the Sunni tradition. As you all know, there was a schism amongst Muslims following the death of the Prophet. What we had is the killing, I hope I'm getting it right, of Muhammad's grandson Ali, and that became the split. The Shia looked back to Ali, the Sunni look back to the caliphates. But amongst the Houthi, they are Zadi, let me get it right, Zaydites. That's about the best with my eyes that you're going to get. What you get is some legitimization of religious leaders who are related to the Prophet. So, in other words, if you took it in terms of Protestantism, if you took the High Church in terms of the High Church in the Church of England, the Anglo-Catholics, for example, these would be people who are sort of officially classed as Protestants, and yet, in terms of their outlook, in terms of much of their religion, they closely resemble the Catholics. But as I said, this isn't decisive. But I think you could say that if the Houthis were in Iran, they might be tolerated, but they would be tolerated if they were tolerated as a heretical sect. But of course, really, what we're dealing with here is the politics of nation, the politics of countries, the politics of states. We're not dealing with some theocratic struggle with its origins in the 8th century or something along those lines. I think just a few words ought to be said as well about the history of Yemen. Historically, at least, South Yemen and Aden have been important as part of the trade route, for spices from India and beyond, up the Red Sea and then over there into the Mediterranean, and fabulous profits for the merchants involved. And in more modern times, of course, Aden was a British colony, a colony especially that was important in the age of coal and then oil, not because Aden had coal, not because Aden had oil, but simply because the Red Sea led to the Suez Canal, and the Suez Canal was the short route for the British Navy and British merchant navy to the crown, to the jewel in the imperial crown, i.e. India. So that was something that was established in the 19th century. Now, my understanding is that in terms of southern Yemen, this is something that the sort of British incorporated as the sort of extension, as the sort of protective zone of their much treasured port of Aden. But also, what's interesting, at least to me, in terms of my age, maybe, is of course that there was a national liberation struggle fought in South Yemen against the British colonialists, which had a particular intensity in Aden itself. And it was led by an organization called the National Liberation Front. From my youth, I also remember an organization called FLOSSY. I think that was the front for something or other, and Yemen would be there somewhere in its initials. But I've been told either this was a British front or it was a Nasserite front. Either way, that one in 1969, I think, no, 67, let me get it right. And in 1969, we had something called the corrective move. And what this was the takeover of the National Liberation Front in South Yemen by official communists who were no doubt there all the way along. And the National Liberation Front was renamed the Yemeni Socialist Party. And under that regime, although the country was amongst the poorest in the Middle East, what you had is quite remarkable levels of social security. Housing was provided, education was provided, equality of men and women were guaranteed in terms of the law, all divorce was introduced, all sorts of progressive measures were introduced. But of course, we know the history. Soviet Union starts to collapse. Not that the Soviet Union, piled resources into southern Yemen. But anyway, it collapses. We have a unity deal with the North, and long story, ins and outs. And we have various civil wars being fought in Yemen, including a southern independence movement. But we also have the Houthis. And these people are successful, really, in taking over what used to be called North Yemen. How much leverage they got in South Yemen, I don't know. Either way, my main point here is that in spite of British and US attacks, I don't see their grip on North Yemen being loosened. And indeed, my expectation would be quite the opposite, that this will actually help consolidate their regime. Okay. Suppose we ought to just mention two other things in that respect. And that's, first of all, the situation in Lebanon and on the border between Lebanon and Israel. That seems also to being ratcheted up. Again, I don't see some sort of Iranian hand simply giving orders. You also have a situation which we need to recognize, just like with the Houthis, that you actually have pressure on Hezbollah from their own base as well. It's not simply a question. There's Tehran just issuing orders, and people sort of snap into action. Also, just finally on that, of course, not only did Britain loyally follow the United States, so did Keir Starmer loyally follow Britain following the United States. So no independent line from the Labour Party. Keir Starmer is very much in the tradition of Labour historically, and isn't even striking a pose similar to Harold Wilson over Vietnam in the 1960s, i.e., one remove, we are not supplying troops. Both Rishi Sunak and the Tories and Labour under Sunak are determined basically to be part of America's most reliable allies in the world. Should be added, by the way, in terms of the demonstration, that we had Jeremy Corbyn speaking, no surprise, but we also had John McDonnell, who I suppose passes, if anyone does, as the leader of the Socialist Campaign Group, the sort of rump Corbynites that are left in the PLP. And no moves at the moment, at least, by Sir Keir Starmer to kick them out. And note in previous demonstrations, we had one Labour MP suspended for using the phrase, but in an inventive way, the river to the sea. He didn't call for one single Palestine or Palestine being free. He called for peace for everyone between the river and the sea. And that got him suspended from the parliamentary Labour Party. So at the moment, the Labour left is gaining a certain courage. It's very hard to describe them as being brave, but nonetheless, maybe they're just being less supine, less cowardly than they have been in the recent past. And half a million demonstrations aren't to be sneezed at, because that is a proportion, not half a million, but that represents a clear portion of the electorate. Okay, just a very brief discussion coming back to one state, two state, and all that stuff. Just looking at the left press, I was looking at Socialist Worker. There's an article by Isabel Ring Rose, and she's arguing that Hamas's armed struggle alone isn't sufficient to bring victory, that what you need on top of that is protest, mass civil disobedience, and strikes. It's true that she does introduce the regional question, but more or less as an afterthought. She seems to imagine that demonstrations, such as, for example, in London, if they were added to with strikes, for example, by transport workers, would threaten the existence of Israel. This is delusional. But what I'm wanting to highlight in this respect, it isn't so much that delusion, i.e., that Hamas armed struggle plus plus is enough to endanger Israel, but the complete absence of any discussion and recognition, at the very least, of the need to neutralize the mass of the Israeli Jewish population. So, in other words, and this is by inference, I readily admit that what Comrade Isabel Ringrose is advocating is a military conquest of Israel by the Palestinians, which is just inconceivable. Okay, so you add regional allies, and that is conceivable. I've already mentioned in Egypt, by far the most populous Arab country, that the regime is unstable. In terms of free elections, we had the election of a Muslim Brotherhood majority, an Islamic Brotherhood president. That's conceivable under these circumstances. But imagine a situation that Egypt joins in Hamas's armed struggle somehow. And it could, it's very generously supplied by arms by the United States. What the United States is meant to be doing, meanwhile, I don't know. I think Egypt is the second largest recipient in the Middle East of American arms. I could be wrong. It might be Saudi Arabia, but hey, it might be a toss-up. But the point is here that, of course, what we're dealing with Israel is an armed camp. We're dealing with a conscript army, but we're also dealing with an Israeli defense force, as far as I know, that has something like 180 nuclear warheads. What does Israel do under circumstances where its existence is genuinely threatened from without? Well, I would suggest that, well, maybe it starts to threaten to nuke Alexandria. Maybe it starts to threaten to nuke Cairo. And maybe it does nuke those cities. That's just an unimaginable scenario. So, from our point of view, in terms of a civilized solution, we actually highlight the necessity, at the very least, of neutralizing, but surely also winning a big slice, a majority of the Israeli Jewish population. In other words, the working class majority in Israel, but majority of working class Jewish people. In Israel. And the other example I just wanted to bring up was in The Socialist, the paper of the Socialist Party in England and Wales. This is an editorial. And what they argue is that Palestinian national self-determination can only be achieved by the mass struggle of the Palestinian people themselves if they're armed with socialist ideas. And what the comrades in SPEW put forward is a two-state solution. Why on earth you'd want a two-state solution if both sides, both the Israeli Jewish working class and the Palestinian working class, were led by socialist ideas is beyond me. But the idea that the Palestinians, by their own effort, can win, again, I think is delusional. I think myself that the balance of forces are overwhelmingly on the side of Israel until you start introducing regional class struggle into the formula, and indeed global class struggle into the formula. And that's why, at least when it comes to the CPGB, yes, we put in to our propaganda for the present time, when it comes to a solution, the necessity of raising socialist demands. Now, we've got a letter from Martin Greenfield in the current edition of the Weekly Worker, I think shows some confusion. There's no problem in raising socialist demands. Are these minimum demands? No, of course they're not. They're maximum demands. Does it mean we have no minimum demands for the present circumstances? Of course we do. I can tell you some. Israel out of Gaza, Israel end the siege of Gaza, Israel reverse the colonization of the West Bank, Israel proper equal civil rights for Arabs and Jews, end discrimination against Arabs, and I could go on and on. They are minimum demands, they are democratic demands, but what I would argue is while at least in theory and clearly in reality, there was a bourgeois solution, not much of a one, admittedly, in South Africa. You can end apartheid, you can have one person, one vote, which is what you've got now. Yes, the masses and their living standards and their poverty remain, but there was a bourgeois solution to the question of apartheid. Is there a bourgeois, capitalist, democratic solution to Israel-Palestine? No. That's the argument. So we don't abandon the minimum program. We don't say only the maximum program, but clearly different circumstances require different solutions. So, of course, if you take the climate question, for example, have we got minimum demands? Yes. But I would argue that fundamentally, if we're going to actually meet the challenge of global warming, what we need is socialist solutions. We need to overcome accumulation for the sake of accumulation, production for the sake of production. We need to break with the logic of capitalism if we're going to have a solution. That isn't simply the solution, but it's what is necessary. And indeed, I've speculated even about the possibility of forces within the capitalist state making such a move. But that is a necessity. But it doesn't mean you chuck out minimum demands. Anyway, moving on. What time are we? 35. Very quick comment on Taiwan. Official name, which I think is a bit of a giveaway, the Republic of China. So the BBC again, I'm sorry about being obsessed by the BBC. I'm British and yeah, I get most of my news, at least when it comes to the airwaves from the BBC. So they constantly tell us, as claimed by China, that Taiwan's just had elections, democratic elections, and it's claimed by China. Well, it also works the other way round. That elections have happened in Taiwan, who also claims to be the government of China, the whole of China. And if you remember the Mao Nixon, the Kissinger Chiang Rai deal, it was some sort of strategic ambiguity. The United States still recognizes, on some level, that the legitimate government of China is in Taipei. It's just that they don't push it. We have the Beijing government with a seat now in the UN and on the Security Council, but this isn't from memory, it's been pointed out to me, but the Americans abstained when it came to that vote. America is pledged to defend Taiwan, but not the independence of Taiwan. So, yeah, the BBC would be in a rather awkward position if every time it mentioned Taiwan, it said, and the government here claims sovereignty over the billion plus Chinese population. But it is worthwhile looking at the election. This is the third term in terms of the presidency. From someone from the Democratic Progressive Party. This is the one that pushes the formula in Taiwan more in the direction of independence, which is a new, this is an innovation in terms of Taiwanese politics, a reason I'll come to. Anyway, we have the vice president now, the president, and he was elected on 40. 0.1% of the vote. Clearly, it's not a two-horse race. It's a three-horse race. I don't know the constitutional situation. Either way, the second place candidate, Hui Yihai, for the KMT, that's the Kuomintang, which was the government in China throughout most of the first half of the 20th century until. The People's Liberation Army, Chinese Communist Party, Mao Zedong entered Beijing and declared the People's Republic of China in 1949. And of course, what we had is the leader of the KMT, Chiang Kai-shek, skate over the straits to Taiwan with a large number of ministers. Soldiers, officials, businessmen, and you name it. And they got in the elections. Traditionally, they were the governing party in Taiwan with that move. They got 33.5%. Then there's a newish party, the Taiwanese People's Party, who are described of, I've got no more information on them than that. This is from Wikipedia, as center left. I'll leave you to guess what. what that means. They got 26.46% of the vote. And then I thought to myself, well, surely there must be some pro-Chinese party. And I'm talking about pro-Beijing party. And there is. And I looked them up, and this is the Chinese Unification Promotion Party, formed in 2004, officially registered as a party in 2005. And they claim 30,000 members. I went to their website, and in all honesty, guys, your membership looks more like it's counted in the dozens. Suffice to say, they didn't have a candidate. And I think that says something. On the other hand, this is the paradox of where we're at the moment. Those that want reunification of Taiwan with China clearly voted KMT. And that would be reunification, not by KMT, as would have been the case under Chiang Kai-shek, somehow going back and fighting a war or just seeing the Communist Party regime in Beijing collapse or some other scenario along those lines. I also think now the KMT seems to be moving in the direction of accepting some sort of version of a Hong Kong or Macau solution. So my understanding is that in China you have five official parties, Chinese Communist Party, but you also have party for the petty bourgeoisie, a party for this, that party for capitalists, a similar situation to the people's democracies in Eastern Europe. Maybe you've already got a party that's the ex-KMT party, or maybe it is the KMT, but the pro-Chinese Communist Party, KMT. Either way, I could imagine under some future scenario that happening with China. In other words, the lack of representation, the lack of an overtly pro-China vote, I think is somewhat masked by the 33.5% vote for the KMT. What we then expect from Xi and China proper, we have been told about war and peace and this potential vote meaning war. I'm not convinced myself. I don't know. I mean, I'll push it no further. But clearly, this represents a potential huge flashpoint in terms of global politics, not least with the United States pledging to defend Taiwan's independence, but not independence in terms of a UDI, unilateral declaration of independence. Just a couple of other points. Ecuador takeover of TV station. When I heard the news, in the past I would have gone, ah, some brave guerrilla fighters have taken over a TV station and are issuing a call to the masses to arm and ready themselves for the revolution. But no, not this time around. My instant inner mind was going, oh yeah, sure, narco gangs, and indeed that is the case. And if you look at the situation in Ecuador, we're more or less dealing with a sort of failed state sort of scenario. But remarkably quickly, if we look back at the recent history of Ecuador, as you know, it's got borders with Peru to the south and Colombia to the west, that this was a relatively stable country. It was part of, in terms of its part of the pink wave. And under those circumstances of what passes for social democracy nowadays, living standards improved, welfare state improved. But what we had is a situation of the right coming into power and a situation of where drugs gangs have dominated the jails and playing a role of basically of a state within a state as the economy has plunged. I'm told that there's less demand for cocaine in the United States. And what's happened is that they're diverting cocaine supplies to Europe, and Ecuador was one of the launch pads for this. I don't know the ins and outs of any of that. I'm dubious that demand for cocaine has gone down in the United States. I don't think that opioids have taken the place of cocaine. They're completely different sorts of drugs. My basic comment here, though, is that here's another living, horrible, foul example of the failure, the criminal failure of the war on drugs. And what we have got figures here in terms of Ecuador. 2017, the figures for murders were 4 in 100,000, 4 murders in 100,000 in terms of the population overall. Way, way below Brazil, way below Venezuela, well below Colombia, well below Mexico. And then we have huge spurt, slight declines in Colombia, slight declines in Mexico, but a spurt up in Ecuador. So we go from 4 in 100,000 to 46 in 100,000. That is a very large number. And of course, what we need to recognize is that murders typically are concentrated on a particular demographic. And I very much suspect here that what we're talking about is an awful lot of deaths amongst young men. That is mainly who's going to be, in the firing line when it comes to these deaths, either meeting it out from drug scans in terms of rival gang drug scans, or the police, or the other way around, the army and the police knocking out drug scans. And I'm told, I've got no reason to doubt it, that these drug gangs have 50,000 members. Why? Simply because there's no other future other than emigrating up north into Mexico and over the border into the United States. So either you have to join a drugs gang, or you have to get out of the country. And maybe you go, from the frying pan into the fire. What are you going to do in the United States if you're a young Ecuadorian or Colombian or Venezuelan? Okay, lastly, in terms of the media in Britain and politics in Britain, I do find it surprising, and maybe I shouldn't, maybe it says something about me. Either way, politics has been, dominated by a drama broadcast by independent television, and its name was Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. And this is a drama about a case that we've known about, and we've known the ins and outs of for years now. So I've already confessed to being a Radio 4 listener. That's the sort of main so-called serious program on BBC Radio. It's not. Either way, they've broadcast some good documentaries on this case, and what it's about is the Post Office, encouraged by Tony Blair and the new Labour government back there when, with the defeat of Thatcher, coming to power of Tony, and the idea that computers and automation are going to revolutionise productivity. They go for the automation of the Post Office, not least sub-post offices. These are shops that also do postal services. That's the general sort of model, the general age group of people who operate as postmasters or postmistresses. I would guess, this is a guess, would be in their 50s. This is something they're doing before they retire. They're not out to make big money. They're out to have a comfortable retirement, but nothing more. So it's a petty bourgeois stratum. Of the population, petty bourgeois stratum that might have come from the top stratum of the working class. They have to have some money. They're not just going into it on the basis of borrowing. They might well borrow. They might, for example, remortgage their house in order to set up this business. But yeah, what we have is, I can't remember, was it the ICL? But anyway, this is a British computer company that was, I think, originally given the contract that is then taken over by the Japanese Fujitsu. Tony Blair is told that the program that they're using in the post office has flaws. I don't know anything else about it, but that came up on his under his watch. And basically, the new Labour government wasn't interested in pursuing the problems. Quite the opposite. It wanted it to be a success. It wanted it to be a success because it done a deal with Fujitsu. It was looking for other companies like Fujitsu coming in from abroad, investing in Britain. I mean, our understanding is what we have is a legal system of where far from computer is wrong, we have a legal system that says computer is right. In other words, what we have is when faults begin to crop up with sub postmasters, the courts listen to the sub postmasters who say, "It wasn't anything to do with me, Gov. I haven't ripped off 10,000 quid or 40,000 quid. I don't know anything about, this money, where it's gone." The presumption by the courts is that the computer and therefore the post office is right, that the evidence produced by the computer, there's the bottom line, there's the missing money. Who's guilty? You are. And what we had is 4,000 managers found guilty. We don't know what the percentage who were really guilty, but the present presumption now, according to this government, is very, very few, and so few that they're going to pardon them all. I mean, that's my understanding of it. But also imagine the trauma that these people went through. Well, maybe you've seen the drama. I just listened to the Radio 4 documentary. We know of at least three suicides as a result of the pressure on these people. What we had is, upstanding, law-abiding pillars of the community who were criminalized. What we had is them, going to prison. What we had is them financially ruined. And what we had is a post office and a government that knew that there was a fault in the system and prevaricated and prevaricated and prevaricated. And it took this drama that was just recently broadcast to sort of shove this from the sort of, well, we all know it, into something must be done and done now category. And it reminds me when I was very much younger of the play for today, Kathy Come Home, that told a shock horror in social democratic Britain that there were young people who were homeless, involuntary homeless. I knew about, old ex-soldiers called beggars, tramps, sure. But young people with a child, crime, shocked the nation. Now, homelessness, no. It's the norm, in post-Thatcher Britain. But yes, what we have also is not only the finger being pointed at Tony Blair, but all government ministers, because what we're dealing with in terms of the post office is a government who owns 100% of this business. You have a minister in charge, and amongst the ministers, who've been named as complacent, to put it mildly, is Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrat Party. And as I understand it, one of the ex-postmasters is threatening to stand against him in the forthcoming general election, which will take a bit of a shine off, the Liberal Democrats' self-image. Remember, they were in the coalition government with the Tories, something that they don't like to parrot. Nowadays.